Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink. We're in our continuing discussion of the book of Daniel. And last time we left off toward the end of chapter 5. And we're going to be backing up to verse 25, where we have the Mina Tekel Upharshin statement, which some have taken as a prophecy, because when you convert that to geras, it adds up to 2,520 geras. And we spent a lot of time talking about the seven times prophecies, both in the book of Leviticus and earlier in the book of Daniel. But before we get back to that, because there was some historical question about, you know, there's such a tremendous gap of time between Daniel chapter 4 under Nebuchadnezzar and then Daniel chapter 5 under Belshazzar, which apparently is a period of around 40 years. And, you know, what happened in those 40 years? And I was researching in Josephus, and he has this to say in Book 10, this is the Antiquities of Judah, Book 10, Chapter 11, Paragraph 1. Now, when King Nebuchadnezzar had reigned 43 years, he ended his life. He was an active man and more fortunate than the kings that were before him. Now, Berosus makes mention of his actions in the third book of his Chaldaic history, where he says thus, when his father, Nebuchadnezzar, or Nabopolassar, heard that the governor whom he had set over Egypt and the places about Celesyria and Phoenicia had revolted from him while he was not himself able any longer to undergo the hardships of war, he committed this to his son Nebuchadnezzar, who was still but a youth, some parts of his army and sent them against him. So when Nebuchadnezzar had given battle and fought with the rebel, he beat him and reduced the country from under his subjection and made it a branch of his own kingdom. And so we know we covered this history last time. That occurred right around 609 B.C., but about that time it happened that his father, Nebuchadnezzar, fell ill and ended his life in the city of Babylon when he had reigned 21 years. And when he was made sensible, as he was in a little time, that his father, Nabopolassar, was dead, and having settled the affairs of Egypt and other countries, and also that concerned the captive Judah and Phoenicians and Syrians and those of the Egyptian nations, and having committed the conveyance of them to Babylon to certain of his friends, together with the gross of his army and the rest of their ammunition, etc. So he took upon him the management of the kingdom, which had been kept for him by that was the principal of the Chaldeans. So someone ruled in his stead. Apparently, according to Josephus, Nabopolassar died while Nebuchadnezzar was off to war, and someone was ruling in Chaldea in Nabopolassar's stead, until Nebuchadnezzar could come back home. He does not name that person, okay?
And, well, it may have just been a court of... I mean, they had to have an order of succession.
Yes, like we do.
Like we have. Or
Nabopolassar sounds like Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, poor Nabopolassar. Just
Boy,
slapped him in the head.
Can you imagine that? Okay, and then... And then he talks about his wife wanting to have control. Okay, we're in big trouble, folks, if this history repeats here in America. Anyway, so he finally says in paragraph 2, by now, after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, evil Merodach, his son, succeeded in the kingdom, who immediately set Jeconiah at liberty and esteemed him amongst the most intimate friends. So evil Merodach is named by Josephus here as a successor to Nebuchadnezzar. I'd never heard that before, okay? And then he names Neglissar, his son. So he says that evil Merodach reigned 18 years, and then his son reigned 40 years. So that that presents a problem in terms of our chronology. So there has to be a mistake here. And then Labasodakis, who continued in it all but 9 months.
And he was the very young man that Nabonidus stole the throne from.
Oh, okay. And then when he was dead, it came to Belshazzar, who by the Babylonians was called Nabonidus. So he equates Belshazzar with Nabonidus. okay, which is probably also a mistake. Because you're saying that Nabonidus usurped the throne until Belshazzar took it over.
Well, Belshazzar never took it over.
Okay.
Belshazzar was co-regent with his father, who was Nabonidus.
Oh, okay.
Or however you want to pronounce it. The we know that from inscriptions that were found.
Uh-huh, okay.
I mean, I was prepared for this discussion 2 weeks ago. I don't have those notes in front of me.
Oh. Yeah. But anyway, so that's the chronology that he gives for the succession from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar. And from our history as we've covered it, all of this took place from approximately the year 609 B.C. to 539 B.C. when the Medes and Persians overthrew Belshazzar. Okay? So his numbers don't add up. His numbers are, you know, considerably higher than the 60, 70 years that the chronology we have established here. In any case, I just wanted to convey Josephus's comments on this. He actually gives the names of the intervening monarchs, you know, which maybe some of these other chronologies leave out. Okay.
Right, and we know some of them from the inscriptions, and Josephus didn't come down to us in perfect form. I mean, there could easily be an error or two in it, or 10 or 20.
Yes.
But, you know, that's
yes.
The way it is. That's
okay.
The way manuscript copying is in the ancient world.
Right, right. And he claims to be copying from the ancient Hebrew manuscripts, okay, and it's quite possible he had made a mistake or two. All right.
Or the scribes that copied Josephus made a mistake.
Right, that's possible too, certainly, yes.
You know,
yes.
I don't know what the state of textual criticism is in Josephus, I don't know.
Uh-huh, okay. So given the year 539 B.C., which is pretty universally acclaimed as the year in which the Medes and Persians took over Babylon, okay? So we back up into Daniel chapter 5, and the handwriting on the wall that was seen by Belshazzar on the night, the same night that he died, verse 25. And this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. This is the interpretation that Daniel is giving to Belshazzar. God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you are weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians, and then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel, and he gave him everything he promised for someone to correctly interpret the meaning of these words. Okay, so Bill, you wanted to comment on these words again.
Yeah, all I want to say is this. Just because 2,520 years seem to have come and gone,
yes,
and Babylon's still been here for 30 more years, just about,
yeah.
It seems to me like that's not the correct interpretation of his prophecy.
Okay.
And I would say that there are many other interpretations of this prophecy that are possible.
Okay.
For instance, we have a date, a clear date of the unbinding of the Babylonian system in 1917.
Yes.
And if you take Mene could mean 50 or 60, and Tekel could mean one shekel, and this these numbers, if we were to accept their interpretation as numbers in various combinations, could have a lot of different meanings.
Yes.
And what I want to say is that doesn't, you know, the 2,520 years having come and gone should not in any way spoil our faith.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Because there are many other prophecies in the Bible that once they happen and we look back at them are extremely clear.
Right.
Like to say that prophecy really is not for our benefit so that we could see the future like God does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we rarely are able to.
Prophecy is really for our benefit so that we know when it's fulfilled exactly like we see it in hindsight,
mm-hmm,
that God is true.
Right, right. Yeah, eventually these things become clear once we study the history of the times, and like last week. So for people who weren't around last week when we discussed this, the only significant thing I could find, you know, 2,520 years after 539 B.C., was the year that Ron Wyatt discovered the blood of Christ on the mercy seat in Jerusalem. And there's really nothing else I could find in that year to correspond to a 2,520-year prophecy, okay?
Right, but I think it would have to have a major impact on the children of Israel. And,
yeah.
And,
well, it's interesting that although the kingdom of Babylon was overthrown by the Medes and Persians, the Israelites in Babylon stayed slaves to their new kingdom, okay? And so it wasn't until 586 B.C., 586 B.C. minus 70, which would be 516, wouldn't be until 516 that the Israelites were allowed to go back to Jerusalem. Okay, so there
well,
was.
Well, that's true, but that's only a very small percentage of them that gained freedom.
That's right.
If you want to consider that freedom.
Well, yeah, and there's only a small percentage of us, namely the remnant, that are going to go back to the new, are going to inhabit or be the government of the new Jerusalem. So maybe that's the symbolism here.
Yeah,
okay.
But not all of history is repeated in the same pattern.
No. But this,
usually the history that is repeated in the same pattern is because we keep screwing up.
All right, exactly. We keep making the same mistakes, you know. But, you know, my reason for bringing it up last time, well, as you pointed out, that Comparé and Swift had the same belief, and there's several others who have the same belief, that this adds up to 2,520. And since we had the seven times prophecies, certainly the one regarding America being the fulfillment of the seven times prophecy from 745 B.C. to 1776 A.D., America is clearly the regathering of the 12 tribes of Israel. There's no doubt about that, okay? And so maybe if this prophecy here, Mina Tekel Upharsin, does in fact have a 2,520 significance, you know, we'll eventually figure that out, okay? And as you said, it may have a different significance, okay? So let me just continue reading here. Verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So the Israelites stayed enslaved in Babylon. It's just that the transition of power took place from the Babylonians to the Medes and Persians. Okay, so let's get into chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts to them, and the king should have no damage or loss.
I only want to make a technical note, really, because of the way this is criticized.
Okay.
You know, it's problematical from a historian's point of view, because Herodotus testifies that the Persian Empire had but 20 provinces as divided in the early 5th century B.C. by Darius.
Okay.
But that was a division that Herodotus explains was made by Darius,
okay,
which is about 70 years after this.
Okay.
And Herodotus actually names those provinces and his histories towards the end of Book 3.
Okay.
Now, Esther claims 127 provinces.
Okay.
Wherever that number came from. But what I'm going to say is that here, these really aren't provinces, they're princes.
Right.
And princes. They could be over a city or over a,
exactly.
Over a smaller, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, and by the time
of
Esther, seven
so
could have been added. You know, so there's not a contradiction here is the important thing. It's not necessarily a contradiction.
Yeah, that's there. All I'm trying to point out. And that's because the critics go hard on certain parts.
Right.
And, you know, they nitpick on everything they can.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so and this is something which would be difficult to verify, how many cities existed in the kingdom of the Medes and Persians, okay? It would be hard to say, you know. Well, apparently 120 and 127 at the most, okay?
Well, yeah, there would have been a many cities. I mean, Herodotus mentions the 20 provinces,
right?
And there are 20 large provinces. I mean, it is a large empire.
Right, right. Just like Canada has, what, eight or nine provinces or commonwealths, I forget what
well,
they call it.
Well, I mean, the eastern United States had 13 states, you know.
Yes.
But I mean, you could set princes up over cities and you would have many more than
exactly
13 princes.
Yes.
That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay, so this is not necessarily contradictory, even those who criticize the Bible constantly for petty things like this. You know, we'll try to point these things out and say, hey, this can't be right. Verse 3, then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm, okay? Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. So he was a good Judahite administrator. Verse 5, then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Okay, so they want to figure out some way of finding Daniel guilty of disobeying the law of Yahweh, but of course that's not possible. Well, let's see what they come up with. Verse 6, then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus to him, King Darius, live forever.
Was a common, yes. All the way back to the Egyptian pharaohs,
yes,
of the third millennium, that was a common address to a king or a ruler.
Long live the king.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's been with us for 6,000 years.
Exactly. Verse 7, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of you, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Of course, they're altering the law, aren't they?
Well, this law, if you look at this carefully, this law was not really meant on its face to trip up people like Daniel.
Uh-huh.
And it does trip up Daniel. It's used to trip up Daniel after the law is passed.
Well, yeah, of course.
And I would equate this to today's hate crime bills.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it trips up only white people, doesn't it?
Well, it trips up the pious people.
Right.
Quite often. And the evil people use laws like this to get to the pious people.
Right, right. Well, the hate crimes law, the various other laws, like the tax code, negatively impacts white people. Only white people pay taxes.
Okay. Well, I would bet it was the Kenites in Babylon that had Cyrus sign this bill here.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
In
Susa, possibly, because Susa was the capital of Persia.
Right.
But.
Yeah, this is a form of a hate crime bill, hate crime legislation.
Anybody with a different god except the king should go into the lion's den.
Right. And so we true Christians who oppose homosexuality, who oppose the Jews taking over our country, who oppose welfare for the people who don't work, such as the vast majority of blacks who are on welfare, okay, only we can therefore be accused of hate. Right? That's the way it works. They never prosecute any Jew or black or homosexual for a hate crime, do they? Doesn't happen, folks.
No, it doesn't happen.
It's selective legislation designed to target the white race. That's exactly what, and this is exactly the type of legislation we're talking about right here. So the Jews are at it again. 5,000 years later, folks, 4,000 years later, they're at it again. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, that's of course Yahweh, as he did before time. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spoke before the king concerning the king's decree, have you not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is that son of a gun Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, and here it says Judah correctly instead of Jews, regards not you, O king, nor the decree that you have signed, but makes this petition three times a day. Then the king went and he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. So it says that the king was displeased with himself. Okay? So would that be a correct statement here?
Well, absolutely. And the king... there are historical instances that once a law was passed by the Medes and the Persians, it could not be changed.
Uh-huh.
I'll give an instance directly contrary to the, and I'm going to say that this is directly contrary to the false testimony of the Esther story.
Okay.
Where a law is changed in Persia.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't be.
Okay.
In Herodotus' histories at book 3, section 31, there it is described that Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus, the son of this very same emperor that we're talking about now.
Okay.
That Daniel's addressing as Darius by title.
Okay, I see.
Well, Cambyses, even though he was the king, he wanted to marry his sister. And there was a law against marrying your sister.
Uh-huh.
But he went to the judges, and they found another law that basically told the king that he wasn't bound by that law.
Okay.
So he went and married his sister. But just the fact that he had to go to the judges to find a way to circumvent a law showed that he wasn't allowed to change the law.
Right.
Even though he was the king.
And that the lawyers came into being at that time.
well, right, yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
That's absolutely true. And lawyers had the same Kenite inclination to find ways to circumvent laws.
Yes.
But
yes.
Herodotus 3:31, and it explains that exact thing. And we see that the Persian kings couldn't change the law.
Uh-huh, okay. So they had to get a way around it by passing a new law.
Well, there was some sort of arcane law. Herodotus describes there was some sort of arcane law that said that certain laws just didn't affect the king.
Yeah.
And they found that, and it was ancient, and it was on their books, if you want to call them books, and it made them
happen. Right. And that applies to Obama today, too, that the Constitution is a piece of paper to him, right?
Well, right, absolutely. And uh-huh. It's very possible that the judges just told Cambyses that, because Cambyses was actually a pretty cruel man.
Uh-huh, okay.
And maybe they just told him that to placate him so that he wouldn't feed them to the lions.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just read an article today that stated that when Obama was visiting in Russia, he stated to Medvedev, or either Medvedev or Putin, that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is virtually of none effect anymore. He actually said that in Russia. So much for the law being eternal, okay?
Well, that should spark an immediate revolution.
It should.
But people don't care as long as they have beer and TV.
Exactly. Very good. So verse 15, now just one more thing here, that apparently this law was only enacted for a period of 30 days. So we still got to be in this 30-day period, right? Is that how you understand it?
Well, I mean, it would seem to be.
Yeah. And so it seems to have been enacted specifically to trip up Daniel, to try to catch him in the act. Just like the hate crimes legislation was enacted specifically to punish white people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so verse 15. Then these men assembled to the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establishes may be changed." Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." And the stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice to Daniel, and because he liked Daniel, all right? And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God, whom you serve continually, able to deliver you from the lions?"
Now note that Daniel's answer, that Daniel's still respectful.
Okay.
He doesn't say, look what mess you got me in.
Yeah, right. Okay, verse 21. Then said Daniel to the king, "O king, live forever." Okay, very respectful. "My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, forasmuch as before him innocency was found in me, and also before you, O king, have I done no wrong." Then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. Now it's interesting that the account that I recall as a child, you know, given this incident here, was like a stadium full of people, you know, and all people observing this. But this account says, well, this occurred in private overnight, okay? I don't know, how do you recall it?
Yeah, it could very well be.
Yeah, okay, but that's the way I was remember being taught the story, that it was a very public thing, and this is telling us this occurred in private.
No, the king doesn't go anywhere alone.
Yeah, right. Well, he just departed and went to bed and came back the next morning. So verse.
Oh, right, but I mean, the Bible always concentrates on the central characters.
Yeah.
And I use an example like when Abraham went and fought. You know, the Bible follows Abraham and Sarah.
Yes.
From Babylonia to Haran and then down to the land of Canaan. And Lot's with them and one or two other people are mentioned, right?
Uh-huh.
And then Abraham goes off to fight the Battle of the Kings with 300 men from his household.
Yeah.
But when you learn these stories as a child, you see a camel in Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? But
yeah,
if Abraham had 300 men from his household to fight in the Battle of the Kings,
right? Like
well, he probably had 1,200 people with him.
Right, exactly.
You know, so the king leaves his palace and goes down and sees Daniel.
Right.
Well, he probably had his whole retinue with him.
That's right. Yeah, and in Genesis chapter 2, they always add an apple.
Yeah, right.
Non-existent apple.
Well, in the you know, in the Bible, it only follows the central characters. In the ancient world, a king, I mean, it wouldn't be very safe to leave your palace alone.
Right.
They always had guards with them.
Yeah, of course not. Yes. Okay, so verse 24. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the lion's den. Then their children and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them and broke all their bones and pieces or ever they became at the bottom of the den. What's this or ever? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's probably forever.
Yeah, it's probably
forever. It says forever in mine, too, because I copied it out of Bible Works. It's
okay, maybe this is a misprint here. They left out the F.
Now, let me say this. Their children and their wives. That sounds really cruel.
Yes.
But in ancient Persia, and Herodotus talks about this often, when you screwed up and when you embarrassed the empire or the king or the kingdom,
yes,
they came to your neighborhood,
right,
and killed everybody.
Yeah,
they went to your village and wiped it out.
That's right.
That's right. What they did, the Persians.
They still do that in the army. If one guy sneaks a can of pop from the forbidden PX machine, the whole company gets punished. Right?
Okay. Well, in Persia, if you turned traitor or if you were a coward or something in battle and screwed up and something bad happened, they would go to your village, wipe the whole thing out.
Right. Right.
I guess they wanted the whole sea line is bad, you know? The whole clan is
bad. Yeah, they wanted trouble from that clan. That's right. Verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even to the end. Praise Yahweh for that. Of course, he must have had to wait till the end of the 30 days from the previous law to make this decree. Verse 27, he delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Okay, so very good. And we found, and we discussed this last time, that Nebuchadnezzar was more than likely a white man, and so were Darius and Cyrus and all these others. Possibly the one usurper may not have been, but if these people were Edomites, they certainly would not have recognized Yahweh. There's no way. Okay?
Oh, absolutely not. This might be the founding of Zoroastrianism right here or something.
Could be.
I don't know. I don't. The Persians were Semites and they were white.
Yes.
And most of the Chaldees were Syrians. And they were white.
They were white also, yeah. All the nations of Genesis 10 were white people. There weren't three categories, Orientals, whites, and blacks, as you're commonly taught. That's just absolute nonsense.
There were always some Kenites around.
Yes, and Kenites were always lurking in the background.
But, you know, today if you go to, I don't know, if you go to Ader in Oklahoma or some small town in Michigan, I'm just trying to come up, Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you're going to see 50,000 white people,
yeah,
but you're going to see a couple of Kenites.
Right.
That's just the way it is.
That's the way they're always
and
around.
And it was the way it was then, too.
Yes, yes, very good. So, chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So let's just discuss and compare what we had earlier in Daniel chapter 2. We had four great beasts. Aren't these the same beasts in greater detail? Isn't that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, these are the same beasts.
Yes.
I don't think it's greater detail, but it's different detail. Yeah, you know
okay,
what I
more
mean?
Detail, yeah.
It's a vision of the same thing from a slightly different perspective.
Yes.
It's the four great beasts of the four empires, and that's going to be well demonstrated here.
Yeah, and because a lot of people want to project the second group of four beasts well into the future, toward the end times.
Well, they're just idiots, and we're going to see that before we finish this chapter.
Right, right.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, so we're actually talking. So apparently King Belshazzar has a very similar dream to the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And so that's what Daniel is addressing here. So verse 5, and behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. So who are these three ribs? These are obviously previous kingdoms that were destroyed by the second beast.
Well, let me start at the beginning and say that the sea, you know, at the beginning of this vision, the sea, as it so often is, and we're going to see that in Revelations 13:1,
uh-huh,
which we're going to compare to this prophecy.
Okay.
And that sea corresponds, it's representative of the mass of peoples.
Right.
The sea.
Yes.
And the beasts are four kingdoms.
Yes.
And I think that the that this little illustration drawn here about the a man's heart given to it, and that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was called that head of gold.
Yes.
And that this is an allusion back to Nebuchadnezzar's madness.
Okay.
Oh, okay, and he was the head of the beast. The Babylon, the king of Babylon was chosen to be the head of the beast.
Right, right.
Basically. Now, so that's symbolic of that, and it's a way to tell us that this is all the same entity.
Yes.
More or less.
Yes.
Now, the three ribs, the bear is Persia, and the three ribs have to be Babylonia, Assyria, and Egypt.
Okay.
Okay, so the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. That represents the Babylonian Empire.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the bear with the three ribs in his mouth has to represent the Medes and the Persians.
Right, the Medes and the Persian Empire.
And the three ribs of Babylonia, Assyria, which the Assyrian Empire is not mentioned here, but it fell before the Babylonians.
Right.
And Egypt.
Yes.
Which the Persians conquered.
Yes. So, and I, as I recounted earlier from the book of Josephus, he talked about how Nebuchadnezzar had gone to Egypt, conquered Egypt, and also Assyria. Okay? So this verifies what Josephus talked about, that the three ribs are Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon. Okay? Because the Medes and Persians basically took over the territory of those three empires, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you want to go into Revelation chapter 13 from this point?
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay, because
let's cover verse 6 first.
Okay. Let's cover all four beasts here first. You're right. Verse 6. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. And this is absolutely beautiful prophecy. I will let you elaborate.
Right. Alexander the Great conquered the whole known world in about 10 years.
Okay.
And that's, a leopard's the fastest animal in the world.
Right.
And that definitely represents Alexander's kingdom.
Okay.
But it had four heads.
Yeah.
Now, Alexander's kingdom, when he died in Babylon, was split into four pieces.
Yes.
And I'm not just blowing smoke out my rear end saying that. And a lot of people in identity say that, but nobody explains it.
Right.
All right. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History, Book 19, Chapter 105, Paragraph 2, explains that upon Alexander's death, there was an agreement between four of his generals.
Yes.
Cassander obtained control of the Greek portions of Europe except for Thrace, supposedly until Alexander's ill-fated son came of age.
Okay.
Okay, so that's head number one.
Right, Cassander.
Lysimachus received Thrace.
Lysimachus, yes, right.
That's head number two.
He received Thrace.
Antigonus received all of Asia, which here, in Diodorus' description, that seems to include the lands as far as the Euphrates.
Right, so Mesopotamia, Western Mesopotamia, probably.
Right. He received control of that and lost it later to the Parthians.
Right.
Now, the Ptolemy received Egypt, Libya, and Arabia.
Okay.
That's four parts.
That's four parts.
And that's Diodorus Siculus.
That's right. That's right. So those, again, are Cassander, Lysimachus. Who was the third one?
Antigonus.
Antigonus? Okay. And then Ptolemy.
Yeah.
And the Ptolemies.
Ptolemy, yes.
So definitely, this verse 6 is definitely fulfilled to the letter. The Alexander's kingdom was split up into four parts. No doubt about it. Okay.
Four heads, and that lasted until Rome.
That
system lasted until the coming of Rome.
Yes, very
because
good.
They could never get along with each other.
Yeah.
They were always squabbling back and forth.
Right.
But that was an agreement.
We should be so lucky.
Right. That was an agreement by these four men that met upon Alexander's death.
Yes.
And split the kingdom up amongst themselves.
Right. So this prophecy is fulfilled to the letter. Very good. Verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. Okay, so we recall earlier in Daniel chapter 2, it was the kingdom of iron, with iron legs and feet of iron and clay. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So let's talk, this is great, let's talk about verse 7.
Well, this can only be Rome.
Yes.
And I see the 10 horns being probably the 10 provinces that Rome was divided into in the time of Caesars.
Okay.
Of the Caesars. And that's the same, basically, as the 10 toes.
Yes.
That's the way I see this.
Okay.
And there's really a double prophecy here. And I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn.
Uh-huh.
Now I believe that this little horn is the papacy.
Right.
And that's where we're going to get into the revelation.
Yes. Okay, finish? Well, let's see. Let's go back, because we have the iron teeth, and we're talking about, we earlier talked about the fact that the Romans had perfected the art of casting iron weapons, and they were able to devour much flesh, okay, with their iron weaponry, okay? So this certainly applies to them. And they stamped the residue with the feet of it, and they went marching around all of, you know, Europe and Egypt and Mesopotamia with their soldiers stamping off the resistance, okay? And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. Now, isn't it true that Rome began as a republic?
Yes, Rome began as, I'm sorry, Rome began as a kingdom.
It began as a kingdom.
It became a republic.
And became a republic. Okay. So wouldn't that be how it was diverse from the other beasts? Or is there more to this?
Well, Rome actually became a republic, then it became a decemvirate, then it became a triumvirate, then
okay.
It became a tyranny.
Yeah, so it had multiple changes in its form of government.
Actually, there are seven, I'm sorry, I don't have the notes, and I might
yeah.
have them if I scramble for them. There were seven forms of government, and a lot of people think that that's the 10 crowns sitting
yeah.
on
the 10. No.
The seven crowns sitting on the 10 horns in Revelation.
Okay.
There were actually seven forms of government in Rome through its history.
Yes, okay. So this is what would be why it was diverse, because the other kingdoms were simply straight kingdoms, although Greece was divided up into four parts, but it never had a different form of government besides the leaders that it had, okay, which were military leaders. Okay, Rome had and Greece eventually became, they had a Senate, okay, but it didn't go through all the changes that Rome did, okay? So I think that's why this word diverse is important here, okay?
And I don't think there were, until the time of Alexander, I don't think there were any two Greek provinces with the same form of government.
Okay.
I mean, the Spartans had an oligarchy. And the Athenians had a democracy, but it wasn't anything like our democracy.
Okay, so democracy just occurred in Athens, but the rest of Greece was up for grabs.
Well, the rest of Greece was ruled by tyrants.
Yeah.
I mean, Syracuse was always under a tyrant or a king.
Mm-hmm.
And there were always different forms of rule in different cities.
Yes.
And the Spartans, the wars between Sparta and Athens are that they're displayed by historians as wars over which form of government would prevail,
right?
The oligarchy or the democracy.
Uh-huh.
But in truth, they were tribal wars,
right?
Because the Spartans were Dorians, and the Dorians preferred the oligarchy, and the Athenians were Japhethite Ionians, and they preferred their democratic. But but basically, I mean, the purpose was political, but the reason was tribal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But only Rome went through this steady progression of different forms of government, which is very interesting. Very few people are aware of the different progressions of government that occurred in the Roman Empire. Okay, and that's all preceding the papacy, right?
Oh, long before the papacy.
Yeah, we're not even talking about the papacy.
I mean, the last form of government is the the Caesars and the I consider that a tyranny.
Yes. Oh, for sure, for sure. Okay, so let's consider verse 8 again. And I considered the horns, and which that you mentioned, these are the 10 provinces of Rome. And behold, there came among them another little horn, which most people, and you're citing as the papacy, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and in a mouth speaking great things. Okay, and of course this. The papacy has always been speaking great things, but
it's always been represented by one man.
Yes.
Okay. Who was basically recognized as the ruler over Christendom.
Yes.
And that was, we'll see it when we get to like Daniel 7:27, but Justinian, and there were two different tens and an 11th here.
Okay.
And I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but Justinian was the 11th emperor of the Eastern Empire.
Okay.
He is the one that established the temporal power of the papacy.
Okay, yes. It was
established by decree by Justinian, and we'll see that a little later in Daniel. I'd like to...
Yeah. Well, here, before we discuss, what is the... Before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. What are you talking... three of these 10 provinces were overcome and joined into one. What's your...
Well, yes, that's a we're going to discuss that at length.
Okay.
As soon as we move on to I'd like to get to Revelation. I got
I think we can now move to Revelation chapter 13.
Well, okay. For the first 9 verses, I'd like to cover Revelation now.
Okay, let's do that. Okay, if you got it in front of you, go ahead.
I have it, and I saw a beast descending out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and upon its horns 10 diadems. And upon its heads, a name of blasphemy. And those 7 heads are the 7 forms of government that Rome had through its history.
Okay.
Which seems to make the most sense.
Yes.
And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and its feet is a bear's, and its mouth is a lion's mouth, and the dragon had given to it its power and his throne and great authority. And let me say that the serpent was the symbol of authority in ancient Egypt and in the Assyrian Empire, and in the Hittite Empire.
Uh-huh.
They openly use the serpent as the symbol of their authority.
Yes, yes.
And I would like to say that Satan rules the world and makes its kings. But this does not conflict with what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar about Yahweh setting over the world the basis of men.
That's right.
And Yahweh makes its kings.
Yes.
However, it's the permissive will of Yahweh that allows these things to be so.
Yes.
And this is the lesson that we're given in the book of Job, that the entire Old Testament scripture was recorded for our benefit so that we can understand how these things have come to pass. But Satan believes that he rules the world, and Yahweh allows Satan to deceive himself too.
Right.
That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. So in verse 2, we're reminded of there's the parallels here in the book of Daniel. We have a beast which has like a leopard.
A leopard, a bear, a lion, and all the same components.
Right.
But
right.
Revelation 13 reveals to us that behind all of these empires,
yes,
has been the power of the dragon.
Right.
Which seeks to rule over the children of Adam.
That's right.
And that's the that's what Christ met up with in Luke chapter 4, where Satan said that he ruled over all these kingdoms and he'd set who he wanted over them. And that's what we're up against still today, but that's part of the fulfillment that Cain would rule.
Yes. Okay, so in verse 3 then, and I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. What is this talking about?
Well, you know, the Catholic Church might look different, but the Catholic Church is Rome all over again.
That's right. That's right.
The Catholic Church is basically, from the time that Justinian decreed that the Pope would have a temporal worldly power, the Bishop of Rome, and also rule over all the bishops of Christendom.
Yes.
From that time forward, and it took a couple of hundred years, but the popes solidified a tremendous power over all the kings of Europe.
Yes. Yeah, it's called the Holy Roman Empire. Yes.
Now, if you take a good look at the Catholic Church structure, you have a pope who's an emperor. You have a college of cardinals, which are equivalent to the Roman Senate.
Yeah.
You have a leagues of nuns that are equivalent to Vestal Virgins.
Really?
You have every
yes.
element of the Roman Empire, and its paganism is encapsulated in the Catholic Church.
Right. Easter is the celebration of the Feast of Ishtar, right?
Well, right. It's all Roman paganism all over again. And the Catholic, you know, you have the cleric. They call themselves clerics, and they have dioceses. And the cleric gets assigned to a diocese.
Right.
And over the diocese is set a bishop or an episcopus, which means an overseer or a supervisor.
Yes.
And the word cleric is actually a Greek word, klerukos, which means an allotment holder.
Okay. Yes.
Okay? It's somebody that held an allotment for the mother city. They
mm-hmm.
held an allotment of land, like a colony,
yes,
for the mother city.
Like
That's
a
what a clericus was.
Like a franchise of Burger King.
So all of these clerics
right.
throughout the world are basically
franchise
supervising
holders.
And overseeing and holding their little diocese for the Bishop of Rome.
Well, now, doesn't that word diocese also imply a tent?
Yeah, you know, I never really thought to look up. I'm sorry, never really thought to look up that word.
Yeah, because we're talking about the ten horns, and you know, obviously there's more dioceses
yeah.
than ten.
Well, diocese wouldn't be related to the word any word for ten. No.
Okay.
No, it wouldn't be.
All right. But that's interesting what the origin of that word would be in the Greek. I don't know if you have it handy, but
yeah, no, I don't. And,
okay.
I could probably get up and try.
And all the world wondered after the beast. And, of course, obviously the Christian world was wondering, because this was basically set up by Constantine. When Constantine went and conquered and claimed his conquering in the name of Christ, or at least in the sign of the cross. Okay.
Well, you know, that I don't know if that's legitimate history, if that's church propaganda.
Right, right. But we can see, I agree with you, that Justinian set up the Roman papacy, gave it the power that it has. Okay.
Yeah, in order to understand it, if anybody wants to really understand Justinian and the connection to Daniel chapter 7, go to Clifton Emmerhiser's website,
okay.
And I think it's Watchman's Teaching Letter 53, but even more so in Clifton's edition of Bertrand Comparé's Revelation series.
Yes.
In part 9, at the end of part 9, Clifton did a long and detailed exposition of this same thing.
Okay, okay.
Connecting Justinian to the little horn of Daniel chapter 7.
Okay, yeah.
And there's no doubt, and we still have a lot to discuss concerning.
Yeah, well, the reason I bring up Constantine is because he's the one who essentially created the political, alliance between, or who blended Christian doctrine with pagan doctrine.
Well,
okay.
Right, but you know, even after Constantine, there were pagan emperors.
Yes, oh, for sure.
And,
yes.
And it wasn't until Theodosius II that Christianity became the official religion of the empire.
Okay. And when
and
was that?
That was 100-something years after
okay.
Constantine.
But another interesting aspect of this, the connection between Imperial Rome and Papal Rome, is the title Pontifex Maximus. Pontifex Maximus meant high priest of Jupiter, which all of the Roman emperors were considered the high priest of Saturn. Okay, they were not just kings, they were actually high priests as well. And don't you know, the papacy retained that title, Pontifex Maximus. That's why they're called pontiff even today.
Right. And Livy, you know, Livy tries to bring the title Pontifex Maximus back hundreds of years.
Okay.
I mean, that's his statement. Livy wrote the history of Rome. He probably, I think he died, man, I might be wrong, but he died in 19 AD maybe.
Uh-huh.
So he wrote around the turn of the millennium. And he tries to attest that he gives the title a much greater antiquity than
okay.
I would be confident in believing.
Okay.
Okay, he even brings it all the way back to the founding of Rome, perhaps.
Okay.
But there's no doubt that Julius Caesar considered himself Pontifex Maximus.
Right, right.
And he claimed that title also by inheritance through the Julii line, which supposedly was one of the founding families of Rome.
Right.
And I don't have a problem believing that because, he was from the patrician class and from a very old family in the patrician class.
Right. Yeah, but, and then also the seat of power returned to Rome. Okay.
Now, Pontifex comes from the Latin word pontus, or the Greek word, actually, originally pontus. A lot of the Greek words came into Latin, which means a bridge.
Okay.
And Maximus means like the chief or the head. So you're like the chief bridge to the god.
Right, right. And so the papal Roman Empire therefore mimicked the imperial Roman Empire in many ways.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And it's I wrote on it at length in Misconceptions Concerning Paul and the Church on my site. But the I just lost my thought. I must.
Well, the reason that, I want to stress this point is because this deadly wound is definitely a reference to the transition from Imperial Rome to Papal Rome. It has nothing to do with any future revival of the Roman Empire, as so many Seventh-day Adventists and others want to say.
Well, right. And, you know, when we read Daniel chapter 2, you know, that says that when the Fifth Kingdom breaks in pieces, all those other kingdoms, they'll be scattered like chaff.
Yes.
You can't revive chaff.
Right.
You can't put chaff back into grains of wheat.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
These are timed. These kingdoms are timed. And the times are evident. And I'd like to read Revelations through 9.
Okay.
And talk about that a little before we get back to Daniel.
Okay.
We'll leave Revelations at chapter 9. And as we proceed through Daniel, we'll pick up the second half of Revelations.
Okay, well, I left off at Revelation 13:3. Do you want to
continue reading? Right. And Revelation 13:1-9 discussed the first beast.
Okay.
And that's the vision of the animal that Daniel sees in chapter 7.
Okay.
And Revelations 13:10 forward discussed the second beast.
Uh-huh.
And that's the papacy. That's the little horn.
Okay.
Okay, so even though John in Revelations 13:3 takes a little aside about the deadly wound
yes.
that was healed. He's still talking about the first beast, which is the series of empires that Daniel
right.
wrote.
Well, let's continue with verse 4 then. And they worshiped the dragon which gave power to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like to the beast? Who is able to make war with him? We're talking about Satan himself and his Holy Roman Emperor, the Pope, right?
Absolutely.
That's what we're talking about here. Yeah. Okay, so obviously we have a modern counterpart with the House of Rothschild being led by the dragon. There's no doubt that the House of Rothschild is being led by the dragon and with their New World Order and everything. But we're talking about Rome. The context is Rome, right? That's what
Absolutely.
We're talking about. Ancient Rome. Verse 5, and there was given to him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, which the popes have always done, and power was given to him to continue 42 months.
Now, here the first beast is dated.
Yes.
It's without doubt. 42 months is 1,260 years.
Right.
3.5 times is the equivalent of 42 months.
Right.
Of days, which is 1,260 years.
Yes.
And this is dating the first beast, not the second beast.
Yes.
As we will see as we proceed through Daniel 7, Daniel chapter 7 dates the second beast.
Okay.
And they add up to 2,520.
Okay.
Okay, to 7 times. But first, Rome fell in the 13th century of its existence. Okay, Rome was very close to 1,260 years old when it, from 750 to 476, it's really close.
Okay.
It's not exact. But if you bring it to the time of Justinian, it's a lot closer.
You're saying 750 B.C.?
Well, 752 B.C. is more or less the traditional date of the founding of Rome.
Okay, I see.
Okay, and when we subtract that from...
Okay,
well,
and so, yeah, well, so 529 A.D. would be the middle point of the 2,520 years. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, but okay. that date... You know, by that's man's reckoning, and
uh-huh.
it's not perfect.
Well,
but that would bring us to 508 A.D.
Okay.
Okay? But when you go to the when you look at the all four beasts together and look at the rise of the Babylonian monarchy, you come even closer.
Okay. All right.
Okay, and I don't have the exact date in my head.
Well, it's interesting because I calculated from the date that Justinian – he actually founded the monastic system, and the same year, and it's 529 A.D., he also kicked the Jews out of the court. So he got tired of them trying to lend him money and giving him bad advice, and so he expelled them from the court. So if you add 1260 to 529, you get 1789, which is the year of the French Revolution. The French Revolution dispossessed the papacy.
It dispossessed the papacy, right?
Yeah, dispossessed the papacy of all of their real estate in France. And then Napoleon, he went down and conquered the papal states and put the Pope in irons. So, I mean, that 1,260 years fits perfectly. Okay?
Absolutely. They both fit perfectly.
Yeah.
I mean, even though I can only get the first 1,260 years to within 20
yes,
years.
Right. But 529.
We're talking about a chronology that is far from perfect.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And the founding date for Rome and the exact rise of the Babylonian monarchy, they can't be distinguished to a year. That there's all kinds of little quarrels and disputes among
right.
the chronologists.
Right. Sure. But the second half of that prophecy really fits like a glove.
Well, right, and that's because we have a much better grip on
right.
chronology in
yes.
the second half.
Yes, okay, very good. So now verse 6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Now, isn't this also prophesied by Yahshua Messiah where he says that someone will come along who will worship himself, pretending to... worship God, but in reality blaspheming him.
Right, and here I think it's talking about the Roman emperors.
Okay.
And not it's not talking about the papacy yet, but I mean they're the same beast, right?
Yes, they are
and
the same beast.
Basically, you could say a lot of the same things about both of them.
Yes, yes, no doubt.
You know, actually, the first the first insurrection of the Judeans was because Nero wanted to set an image of himself up in the temple.
Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, well, they believed their own rhetoric. I am
yeah,
God.
Yeah, well, they were into Caesar worship. They were
yes.
into big time.
Yes. And that's what the high priest of Jupiter was. He was the God incarnate. That's what he was. Verse
Many
7.
Many of the historians refer to Claudius as the deified Caesar.
Okay,
they refer
yes.
to Julius as the deified Caesar.
Yes. Yeah, they
deified
themselves.
They refer to Augustus as the deified Caesar.
Yeah.
Well, all through their histories.
Yeah. And the rabbis also deify themselves, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Verse 7. And it was given to him to make war with the saints, to overcome them, and power was given him over all the kindreds and tongues and nations. Okay, well, this, again, this is true of both imperial Rome and papal Rome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It applies to both.
Right. And I think we're still talking about the first beast here, but well, we are, but it applies to both.
Okay. All right. Verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. In other words, all I suppose you could say all the non-Israelites.
Right. And many of the people of the empire definitely worship the Caesar.
That's right.
Now.
If any man have an ear, let him hear. Shall we continue in the verse 10? Because it continues here. He that leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. And okay, so in
if
other
one
words,
is now I'm gonna read the Greek.
Okay.
Right, or read my rendering of the Greek. If one is for captivity, into captivity he goes. In other words, this is talking about predestination. If
right.
one is to be slain by the sword, he is to be slain by the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Thus is the patience and the faith of the saints.
Yes.
In other words, your lot in life has been assigned by Yahweh.
Right, right.
That's what this is saying.
Well, those kingdoms that have been set up will, you know, and they will be destroyed by their own devices, in other words. And so we can expect the same thing to happen to the eighth beast, Mystery Babylon, the House of Rothschild. We can expect that to happen to them, too.
Well, we'll do a segment on
Revelation. It requires the patience and the faith of the saints, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, yes. Okay, do you want to continue with verse 11, talking about the second beast?
No, I'd like to go back to Daniel 7:9 and probably not want to discuss this verse 11 in Revelation 13 until we get into
okay.
Next week.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, it's... yes. We're probably not going to get that far along. You know, when Daniel talks about the explanation of the interpretation of this vision is coming next.
Uh-huh.
And it's coming up in the second half of chapter 7.
Yeah.
And that makes it a lot clearer.
Okay. All right, so we left off at verse 6 before going over to Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 11, I think we just read. So verse 7 now in chapter 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, it had great, I think maybe, oh yeah, I went past this already, sorry.
Start at verse 9.
Okay, yeah, I'll start at verse 9, exactly. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. You want to comment on this verse?
This image seems to be complemented by that in Ezekiel chapter 1.
Okay.
And the statement, there's, you know, where it talks about this vessel descending from heaven.
Yes.
That had the spinning wheels with the faces and the symbols that are basically the same symbols around the tabernacle, right?
You're right.
The man and the bull and you know, they were the Israel symbols, the eagle and the lion.
Yes.
And, also in Job 26:9 is a statement. He holdeth back the face of his throne and spreadeth his cloud upon it.
Uh-huh.
That seems, I mean, a lot of people, ufologists or UFOologists or whatever
right.
you want to call them, that they point to these things.
And
I'm not saying that it's not possible, but
right.
but that's the that's definitely the poetic description being drawn.
Right, they take it literally, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's quite possible there was a spaceship involved here who was translated into heaven, Elijah.
Right, and the transfiguration on the mount points to the same thing,
yes.
and a few other things. In
right. Okay. So, So now, but this is actually kind of an aside because he's looking at the throne of heaven. Okay, so verse 10, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered to him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. Okay, verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words of which the horn spoke, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now, with the horn, are we talking about Justinian here or the papacy?
Well, this is, yeah, we're talking about the whole system.
Okay.
And all the people that that were partook in it.
Yes.
All the people that worshiped the beast. And that's, you know, I see this as an end time prophecy. This is a prophecy of the judgment day.
Okay, yeah, because it says...
And the burning flame where the beast is destroyed, Frenchman...
Yes.
...is the lake of fire of the revelation from which there is no coming back.
Right, right. And there's no coming back from that.
It intends permanent destruction.
Yes, yes. Okay, yes. As I said, these two verses appear to be an aside. Let's continue with verse 12. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Okay, what's your interpretation here?
My interpretation is that this is where we are today.
Okay.
The second beast is dead.
Yes.
But we still have to put up with these people.
Right.
We're in the season and a time.
Right.
Which it's a very it's a very obscure statement. What
yes.
the heck is a season and a time? I can't tell you.
Right. Right.
And I looked at the Greek and I looked at the Hebrew this afternoon when I was making my notes, and it seems to be where we are now.
Right.
Because we're no longer under the rule of the series of empires or the papacy.
Right. Right.
Well, and it's an indicator. I believe now we're in Revelation 17:17. Which is that for a time their kingdom will be handed over to the beast, but
yes.
that's not that you know Daniel's not discussing that.
Right. Okay. Well, my interpretation, taking it back to the ancient world, is that when, for example, the Babylonians were defeated by the Medes and Persians, the Babylonian Empire wasn't totally destroyed overnight. It hung around for a while. Okay. And the same thing was true of the Medes and Persians when they were conquered by the Greeks. The Medes and Persians hung around for a while, okay? They weren't destroyed overnight, and they survived quite a bit longer after the decisive battles, okay? And the same is true of the Greeks. In fact, you could say of the Greeks, after the Romans defeated the Greeks in a series of wars, I think the final date was like 313 B.C., something like that, Greece, it was referred to as the Greco-Roman world. Okay.
Well, right, and there are probably still to this day some. I'm sure there are some legitimate Greeks.
Yes.
I mean, I know a lot of blonde Greeks.
Legitimate Greeks. Yes.
Well, yeah, that aren't Turks.
Exactly.
Half the Greeks are Turks and Jews.
That's right.
And it might be more than half.
Mm-hmm. Definitely more than half. Yeah. Today, for sure. Okay, so verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. We're definitely talking about the judgment day here. And there was given to him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Now, of course, you know, we have to consider that the kingdom that Yahshua is establishing here wasn't established overnight either. At the first advent, he simply forgave the Israelites their sins and made the transition from the old covenant to the new covenant, but the kingdom hasn't arrived yet, has it?
Well, the kingdom's always been here, but they're just not in charge of the government.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, he set things up so that the kingdom could be established. But, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel in chapter 21 and 22 of the book of Revelation, that new Jerusalem, that has not been established yet, at least not on planet Earth, okay? It's being prepared.
Right, but
yes.
The kingdom is here. The kingdom is the people.
Yes.
And,
oh, yeah,
the people
definitely.
Here.
The Israelites who are, those Israelites who are prepared to accept the kingdom, that kingdom is here, yes. Verse 15. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me known the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four, kings, verifying what we've been discussing earlier, are,
which shall arise out of the earth, verse
17. Right, okay, verse 17, verse 18. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Yeah, praise Yahweh. I can't wait for that day, verse 19.
Well, to me, that day is come.
Okay.
Okay, that day came. You know, and I'm not saying it's perfect because there's a lot of other prophecies in place. So don't take me wrong.
That has to be fulfilled yet, yes.
But when Napoleon ended the temporal power of the papacy,
yes,
who gained the hegemony over the entire world?
Well, temporarily,
the Anglo-Saxons, basically. The Anglo-Saxons
and
then America.
Okay. The Anglo-Saxons, right. Okay.
But not the French.
Well, Napoleon had a hegemony for 17 years or thereabouts.
Well, yeah, but it was never it was always restricted to the continent.
Yeah, right. Yes.
France was already on a decline.
Yeah.
They were already losing America. They'd already lost America. In fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Louisiana Purchase was conducted in 1805.
Right.
And Napoleon had already lost, you know, he was already losing the French, you know, the French world reach.
Right, right. Yeah, with all his wars, which he started to lose, and finally lost it at the Battle of Waterloo, yes. So, but yeah, that was, and that's the fulfillment of the prophecy that the seventh beast would endure for a short season. Yes, okay.
Right, so, and I'm not discounting the rest of the Europe, but since the temporal power of the papacy ended, the Anglo-Saxon people have basically ruled the world.
Right.
I mean, we've always had Satan right over our shoulders. But they basically ruled the world.
Yeah, and I would say, too, to complement what you're saying, is that the Lutheran world, the Protestant world, probably better put, the Protestant world, basically took over Europe after all this happened, okay? You know, the Christian white Protestants had triumphed over the papacy at this point.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay, verse 19. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured broken pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. In other words, aren't we saying here that the papacy was overthrown? Or the ancient Rome, as we understand it, in its two phases, was overthrown?
Well, this is, you know, Daniel goes into a digression, and he's deep. He's explaining things that he's already elucidated.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, well, he's recounting statements he made in verses 7 and 8.
The papacy was really just an extension of ancient Rome, of which the Holy Roman Empire was also a vehicle.
That's right.
I have notes, but they're not until verse 724, and they include what's
okay.
spoken of there.
Well, I think verse 21 verifies the interpretation I'm suggesting. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints.
Well, right, absolutely. And the popes made war with the saints all throughout their history.
Right, and prevailed against them.
They either used them against the Arabs,
yes,
which is basically, you know, we're being destroyed right now because Wall Street is using us against the rest of the world.
Yes, right. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Okay, so this looks like it's now, we're back into the end times because we're not totally in possession of the kingdom yet. It's within us as a potential in the physical realm, and it will be physical. It will be a physical kingdom. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, absolutely.
About that.
It's the kingdom of heaven, not the kingdom in heaven.
Right, exactly. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth. We're talking about Rome, in which the second phase of Rome lasted until 1789 or thereabouts, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. and the Protestant saints broke it into pieces.
There's a few things I'd like to talk about here.
Okay.
Because this is, you know, this is a very broad look at history that Daniel's just taken these last
20 verses. That's right. It's very broad, yeah.
And the horns, all right, we have 10 horns in that are alluded to in 7:7 and 7:20, in verses 7 and verses 20 here.
Yes.
They seem to indicate 10 kingdoms.
Yes.
Okay. But 7:24 talks about 10 kings.
Yes.
Okay, shall arise, and another shall arise after them. And that is definitely, to me, an indicate. I think that's different than the 10 horns of 7:7 and 7:20.
Okay.
Talked about 10 kingdoms. This is talking about 10 kings, and Justinian was the 11th emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire.
Okay.
Another shall arise after them. Okay? And I have a list. I could name the first 10 emperors. There were definitely 10 emperors before Justinian.
Okay, you're talking
in the
about
Eastern Empire.
Yeah, you're talking about the Eastern Empire, not Rome itself. You're talking
right,
about Byzantium.
The Eastern Empire.
Yes, okay.
Now, Justinian subdued 3 kings.
Okay.
Now a lot of commentators, I think every commentator gets this wrong.
Okay.
They try to name the 3 kingdoms that Justinian subdued.
Okay.
And it says he subdued 3 kings,
yes,
not 3 kingdoms. Okay? Now, if you read Procopius's history of Justinian's wars, and Procopius was an eyewitness to them, Justinian, during his career, defeated 3 notable Gothic, Germanic
right,
kings.
Okay.
Okay? Gelimer, the Vandal king of Carthage, Vitiges, the king of the Ostrogoths, and the Gothic king Totila.
Okay.
Okay? They were 3 kings that were definitely of the saints of the Most High.
Right.
That had helped destroy the, you know, Western Roman Empire, and Justinian defeated the 3 of them.
Okay.
Actually, Belisarius did it in Justinian.
Now, was this when he came back from Byzantium to Rome to defeat them?
Well, it was Belisarius that did the work.
Oh, okay.
You know, Belisarius was his greatest. Belisarius was the greatest general of the sixth century AD.
Okay.
And he was Justinian's, you know, primary general.
Uh-huh.
And he's actually the one that did the defeating. And
right.
Oddly enough, you know, Belisarius was born a German.
Okay.
Okay,
yeah.
He was of German stock. And Justinian is not a Greek. He's an Illyrian.
Okay.
He's a Dardanian, according to Procopius.
Okay.
So he's actually, the Dardanians were dwelling in what was known as Illyria, and they are from the dispersion of the Trojans.
Right. So he's a Judahite.
Definitely.
He's a descendant of Judah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Same thing. And think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. So now we're talking about the Eastern Empire, right? Still,
we're talking about the Eastern Empire, but we're talking about not about the empire, but we're really talking about what Justinian established.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And Justinian established the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome,
yes,
over all the rest of Christianity within
right,
the empire.
Right, right.
Justinian established the temporal power of the papacy. Justinian changed the laws. He recodified Roman laws
right,
in something called the novels or the novellae constitution.
Yes.
And it was a recodification of Roman law that the people of Europe have is the basis for their law to this very day.
Right, right, exactly. Exactly.
Except the English, who have the common law as the basis.
Right, and weren't there 10 major laws that replaced, you could say they replaced the Decalogue of the Israelites?
Well, it's there's a lot of parallels.
Yes.
I'm not that familiar with the internal workings of the Constitution.
Right. Okay, very good. So, but was there a parallel development in Byzantium where that would correspond to this 1,260 years from 529, let's say? Are you aware? Because I know Byzantium fell around 1453 AD,
Well, right, and I don't see anything particularly relating to Byzantium.
Okay.
I mean, we have a Holy Roman Empire, but that only lasted maybe 1,000 years.
Right, right.
And,
okay.
And maybe from Justinian to the end of the Holy Roman Empire, but that doesn't really matter because we have a division between the East and the West, I think in the 9th or 10th centuries.
Okay.
And
yeah.
And they actually, you know, were granted two separate faiths,
yes.
You know, in the scales of God's justice.
Okay, so...
The Holy Roman Empire was a vehicle of the papacy in Western Rome.
Right.
And never of Byzantium.
Yes. Okay, yeah. So this dividing of this time, times, and dividing of times, again, is another reference to 1,260 years.
And I think it's Daniel dating the second beast.
Yes.
John dated the first beast.
Okay.
As we saw in Revelation chapter,
right,
chapter
right.
13.
Right, right. Okay.
Daniel's dating the second beast.
Okay. And so definitely from 529 A.D. to 1789 A.D., that's when the French Revolution occurred, and that was the beginning of the end for the papacy.
And there's no doubt. That's 3.5 times.
Yes.
It's 1,260 years. And that's how long the popes ruled over the kings of Europe from the time of Justinian.
Right.
And that, you know, it took them a couple of centuries to garner that rule, but Justinian made it possible.
That's right. Very good. Okay, verse 26. But the judgments shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy to the end, which we've just been discussing. Verse 27. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints. That can only be white Israelites, folks.
And that's the Anglo-Saxon people
that's
that
right.
gained the hegemony over world affairs.
Right.
And I'm not saying that was all for the good, because believe me, most of it wasn't.
Right.
But we basically, the Protestant peoples of Northern Europe have basically ruled the world and had their own way and have been ruled over by no other peoples ever since the Pope fell.
Right.
Ever
right.
since... 1789.
Yeah, and you could throw in the Industrial Revolution in there as well, which the Anglo-Saxon people created, which changed the structures of governments as well, okay? So that definitely had a major impact. And so so verse 27 is fully fully provable here. The Anglo-Saxons definitely established a dominion, a kingdom and a dominion, shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. And, of course, it doesn't look very good right now, folks. But,
well, this is another prophecy.
Yes.
You know, I believe we're in that time in Revelation 17:17 where it, and Yahshua alludes to it in Matthew 24, and it's our disobedience that's caused it.
That's right.
That our kingdom would be handed over to the beast.
Right.
And it's we're nearing the time for the judgment.
Well, he only guarantees that the elect and the remnant, the 144,000, would not be fooled by the designs of the Antichrist. And the vast majority of our people have been fooled. There's simply no doubt about it. But that does not affect the everlasting nature of the kingdom, which will last forever. Okay. Verse 28, thus far is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Okay. And as it says in Daniel chapter 12, these things will not be understood until the latter days. And so, as you said earlier, with hindsight, we have been able to digest all of this prophecy and analyze it into the various fulfillments.
Right. There's, I'm going to say that there's no way that a man can read prophecy and tell you what's going to happen.
That's yeah. Well, yeah.
But when you read prophecy and you know what's happened and you understand history, it's crystal clear.
Yeah, it is.
I would like to take this time to compare this to Revelation 13, but we might have to do that next week.
Yeah, if it's going to be a long dissertation, why don't we save it for next week? But
well, we could recap this and next
yes.
week and spend half an hour and go over the second half of Revelation 13.
Yes, yeah, exactly, because the parallels between Daniel and Revelation are simply fascinating and outstanding and obvious, really, when you look at them really carefully. And so we discussed the parallels with chapter 13. You say you want to go to chapter 7 next time, or 17?
No, but Yeah, so cover the second half of Revelation 13 before.
Oh, okay, okay. Back to Revelation 13. Okay, yeah. So let's do that. We'll do a brief recap of Daniel chapter 7, go into back into Revelation 13, and then proceed with Daniel chapter 8.
I don't believe how fast the last 90 minutes went.
Yeah, right. It really went fast. Yes. Okay. Very good. And, yeah. And somebody says the earthquakes are starting. So that's going to happen. Well, that has been happening. There's been a tremendous increase in earthquakes in the last 20 years. The rate of earthquakes around the globe has increased dramatically. So all the prophecies made by Yahshua Messiah in Matthew 24. Are coming to pass with greater frequency. So thank you, Bill. This has been a tremendous venture into the world of prophecy and how these things have been fulfilled in historical. And fortunately, we have good historical records of all these things, which the Jews have not been able to distort. They've really distorted modern history to a great extent, but they haven't been able to distort this older history, and we've been able to compare it to prophecy pretty carefully. So thank you for your insights, and thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to continue this discussion next Friday. Oh, wait a minute. Next Friday is Thanksgiving weekend, right?
Yeah, next Friday we have a special schedule, and I'm working
on it. Right.
I'll make an announcement. I will be here next Saturday. I won't be here next Friday.
Okay.
Pastor Jeremy Visser will be filling in for us
okay.
on Friday and Saturday. And the Sunday show we will have to leave with to be announced, right? Your
yes.
Christian Israel program.
Right. Okay, yeah. So next weekend being Thanksgiving weekend, I have a previous commitment, and Bill actually does too, but Bill's going to try really hard to squeeze a couple of shows in Saturday and Sunday, is it? Possibly?
Yeah, I'm definitely going next Saturday with Pastor Jeremy Visser. We're going to discuss the divinity of Yahshua Christ.
Okay.
And Friday is Pastor Jeremy Visser will be here, and the schedule is tentative, and on Sunday the schedule is your Voice of Christian Israel program is just open right now.
Okay.
I mean, I'm going to try to fill it in. But.
Right. Okay. So then we'll pick up on Daniel then in 2 weeks from tonight, not next week, okay?
Yes, we will.
All right. Very good. Thank you for listening, everybody. Tomorrow, Yahweh's Covenant People will be continuing in the book of Acts. Looking forward to that. It's great fun discussing the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. It's really miraculous stuff. And praise Yahweh.
Absolutely.
Good night.